Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome once again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be looking at the second part of the Battle of Britain. Hopefully we won't run over into a third, but it's better to kind of pace these things out and do them in detail. Anyway, I'm going to try to make this as succinct and therefore painless as possible. So if you remember, the last time we were talking about the Battle of Britain, and the preparatory stages, focusing on Hitler's objectives for Operation Sea Lion, and the poor preparation that had gone into the German air offensive over Britain. What emerged is the fact that the Luftwaffe are far less prepared than they actually think. There's an awful lot of bravado within the Luftwaffe and within Hitler's government itself, believing that following the Battle of France, as everything else, is a fait accompli, and the British are defeated before the first shot of the Battle of Britain's actually been fired. And surely the Britain has no more fight in it and will come to terms. Well, the events of the 24th of July proved to be something of a wake-up call, at least for the Luftwaffe, if not for everybody else. Adolf Galland, the Luftwaffe fighter ace, took 40 Messerschmitt Me-109s and 18 Dornier 17 bombers to attack a convoy in the Thames estuary. We're still in a period that the Luftwaffe described as the Canal Kampf, or the Channel War. The Thames estuary obviously leading directly into London, so they're getting closer towards an attack on London, but not quite. Three squadrons of the RAF rise to meet them, Spitfires, exclusively no Hurricanes, and the RAF are badly outnumbered. Galland was surprised, only two German aircraft are shot down, but Galland was surprised about the tenacity of the British, about how hard they fought and how doggedly they stuck to the ME-109s, trying to bring them down. And he berates his squadron when he gets home, and he says basically, you should have wiped out the RAF, but you didn't do. You guys need to try harder. But secretly, Galland was concerned about the tenacity of the British, and he thought that this was an ill omen for the future. But what he had to say in his official reports is entirely different and muted, and don't really get to pass on these observations, particularly to someone like Goering, who doesn't want to hear them. The first official day of the Battle of Britain, the Adlertag, the Eagle Day, was set for the 13th of August. There are obviously all sorts of issues surrounding weather forecasts and weather predictions and that kind of thing that meant that the date has to be put back slightly. But the biggest attack comes on Portsmouth, on the naval base there, and there are wide-ranging attacks on airfields across the southeast of England. However, the reconnaissance that had been done was sufficient and was up to date, but it was how the intelligence was sifted and interpreted, i.e. what Air Force Luftwaffe intelligence officers there were interpreting the aerial photos in Germany, that led to all sorts of poor intelligence failures on the first day. Many of the airfields attacked were not from fighter command, so the knockout blow doesn't come. When the skies clear that day, radar posts pick out 300 aircraft heading towards Southampton, and they're intercepted by 80 fighters. And this was quite a shock to the Germans, who are using slow Stuka dive bombers. This is pretty much the first and the last time they use them. Six are shot down in one go. So on the Eagle Day, there were 47 enemy aircraft shot down, so 47 Luftwaffe aircraft shot down, 13 RAF planes were shot down, and 3 RAF pilots killed. And the Germans obviously lose much more, far greater numbers of aircrew, 89 killed or taken prisoner. The first day is a resounding disappointment for Goering, but it doesn't stop him on the 15th sending an attack wave of 1,790 fighters and bombers that fly all the way from Norway and Denmark and northern France. And the day is, if anything, an even greater disaster for the Luftwaffe. Referred to as Black Thursday, the Luftwaffe lost one-fifth of the entire attacking force that day. However, the problem for the RAF was that despite their high kill ratio, they're enormously outnumbered. The aircraft factories haven't started to churn out the 450 or so additional fighter planes necessary that they do later on in the Battle of Britain each month. The airfields are coming under immense pressure only a couple of days into the Battle of Britain, and there are ground crew being killed who are as essential as the pilots, aircraft fitters, radar operators, members of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, fighter aircraft, ground crew and others. The last outing of the Stuka dive bomber is actually on the 18th of August, when 18 are shot down by 43 Squadron, proving the obvious point that ground attack aircraft are no match for fighter escorts. It was the new RAF pilots that had the highest rate of losses. More experienced, more seasoned pilots managed to learn about where to look for fighter aircraft in the sky. The fresh pilots who would turn up as reinforcements would normally be woken early, about 5 a.m., by the ground crew, and they'd be driven out to a hut on the airfield, the dispersal point, where they'd be fed, and then they would wait around reading, having a game of cards and a cigarette, for the call to action. Unfortunately for a lot of these guys, the weather in August of 1940 is absolutely stunning. Beautiful blue skies, and these are deadly conditions in which to be facing the Luftwaffe, as they are above and you have to fly up to meet them, and they can see you coming much more easily than you can see them. Those that would survive their first action then landed and would go through the same process again. There might be only half an hour between raids and the pilots being scrambled. And so some days the pilots would have to collapse into exhaustion or exist in a kind of a permanent non-sleep as they contemplated whether they would survive till the end of the day. And this, of course, had huge consequences for their mental health. Those pilots that survived the Battle of Britain, many reported having all manner of trauma and depression, anxiety and other side effects, emotional and psychological side effects, as a result of the strain that they were put under. Sector controllers on the ground would communicate using radio to the squadron leaders, who would instruct the squadron on what to do, where to go, and where the enemy was coming from. The objective of each RAF fighter squadron was to disperse the bombers. Bombers on their own were very vulnerable, and to do this as quickly as possible before the fighter escort that was flying several thousand feet above the bombers was able to intervene. Spitfires, in this instance, would take on the fighters, they being the faster fighter aircraft, and the slower Hurricanes would focus on the slower bombers. It should be remembered that the majority of pilots in the Battle of Britain were under the age of 22, much as with Bomber Command and later the US Army Air Force's bomber fleets across Europe. It was difficult to get older, more cautious men to take the kinds of risks that younger aviators were going to. The conditions for Luftwaffe pilots were also highly unfavourable. Many of them lived in mess huts on the other side of the channel, on the Pas-de-Calais, on quickly built and improvised airfields. Most of the airfields they flew for hadn't been seized from the French. They were built from scratch, and so very rough and uneven. And there were very poor facilities for the Luftwaffe pilots there. The ME-109 was a very powerful and quite a difficult aircraft to fly, and was really quite problematic for new pilots who'd been rushed into the battle. Goering was a fairly unsympathetic taskmaster. And unlike Hugh Dowding, who spent a great deal of time focusing on the morale of the aircrews, knowing it was essential, and knowing that low morale was going to perhaps bring Britain to its knees, Goering simply saw the Luftwaffe as a factory where the kinds of results that he could provide the Führer with of bombed airfields, destroyed RAF planes and downed pilots would be produced, and in large numbers. And when they weren't, because of the problems we've already identified, Goering is mercilessly unsympathetic. However, the key question of fuel and flying time was causing the Luftwaffe all manner of difficulties. Again, this is a big clue to us that the Battle of Britain is really poorly thought through and a rushed job by Goering particularly. The ME-109s can't spend very long over southern England and have to peel away, leaving the bombers exposed as they attack airfields. There just isn't enough flying time from northern France to southern England and back again to give adequate cover so that a serious amount of damage can be inflicted on the RAF.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
There's something kind of inimical to Nazism in what happens next. Goering was given a intelligence assessment in mid-August, which was overly optimistic about the level of damage being done to the RAF. There are other intelligence assessments which are far more realistic, but Goering only chooses to believe the ideas that are most in line with what the Nazis want to believe anyway. Anything else is considered to be defeatism and against the will of the Führer and that sort of thing. Now, this isn't just over-optimism. It is a trait of Nazism, of the kind of the constant dynamism of Nazism, i.e. the will to action over, shall we say, hesitation or reflection or pause for thought or change in strategies. And the idea at the heart of Nazism is that will conquer all. It's all you have to do is be decisive enough and determined enough, and the world will bend to meet your will. Obviously, the world doesn't do that, and poor intelligence is something that defeats armies the world over. Goering's refusal to listen to more realistic intelligence assessments to slow down or to alter or to suspend or to change strategy is not just foolishness on his part, although the man was immensely capable of that, but it was something that runs right to the heart of Nazi ideology, and it's a key reason, I believe, why the Nazis were defeated finally in the Second World War, that the refusal to bend to reality and the belief that willpower will triumph was tested quite literally to destruction. The real experts were, of course, the Luftwaffe pilots, who could have told Goering that the RAF was not about to collapse, and that even when Goering focuses the attentions of the Luftwaffe again and again and again on RAF airfields and tells them each day that they're a couple of hours away from final victory, all that he engenders amongst his men is disbelief and contempt. Hugh Dowding was well aware that the battle was always going to have been a long struggle, one of wearing down the enemy and of preventing oneself from being worn down. And even though on nearly every day the RAF shot down more Luftwaffe pilots than they themselves lost, the reality was that the RAF had far fewer resources to start with than they could afford to lose. New fighter planes pouring out from factories, courtesy of Lord Beaverbrook, Max Aitken, and his Ministry of Aircraft Supply, was one thing, but it was the shortage of actual pilots that was the real difficulty. Spitfires can be made quickly, pilots take a while to train. And green pilots, as we already know, are extremely vulnerable and likely to die in their first battle. Fighter Command was also becoming divided over the question of tactics. The Air Marshal Trafford Lee Mallory, the commander of the 10th Group, which was north of London in Buckinghamshire, thought that an approach called the Big Wing strategy should be used, which meant that you concentrated numerous squadrons together in a massed attack. The first person to have suggested this was the famous wing commander Douglas Bader, who in the post-war era became a sort of a national celebrity in Great Britain, featured in the film Reach for the Sky by Kenneth Moore. And he was famous in no small part because he was a double amputee and lost both legs in an air crash before the Second World War had begun. He flew across the South Downs piloting a plane with prosthetic legs. The Big Wing was slow, though. By the time most squadrons had assembled into a massed formation, the Luftwaffe had gone home. Dowding didn't believe in the Big Wing strategy. But the debate was kind of superseded on the 24th of August when the Luftwaffe accidentally overfly their targets and bomb central London purely by accident, but it doesn't look like that at the time. Churchill decides to launch retaliatory raids on Germany, knowing full well that the military results that are going to be pretty much negligible, and that the air crews are certainly at a high risk of not returning home. However, at the time, it's propaganda gold, the sort of thing that Churchill was crying out for. The opportunity to present Britain as the victim of a terror attack from the air, and thusly retaliating in the only way that seems justified. And also, Churchill was able to demonstrate to the British public that on some level the British were still in the war and still taking the war to Germany. And this was again another nod to Roosevelt, showing that Britain hadn't given up and was still fighting and able to hit the enemy where it hurt. It proved to be the salvation of RAF Fighter Command, as Goering took the decision to move the attack away from the airfields and to attacking Britain's cities. This again was a major tactical blunder by Goering, whom, had he continued the pressure on the airfields, may well have actually broken the RAF and killed large numbers of the vital ground crew and the infrastructure that kept pilots in the air and directed them to where they needed to be. The day in which the Battle of Britain was decided was on the 7th of September. Goering and a coterie of Nazi grandees and generals and SS men stood on the cliffs of the Pas de Calais and watched 1,000 aircraft in a massive attack fly towards the White Cliffs of Dover. The fighter command put 11 squadrons in the air over the southeast of England, and the people of Kent particularly were able to look up and see this terrifying spectacle in the air above them. And what they were really witnessing was the beginnings of the Blitz in earnest, as the direction of the bombers was taking them towards London's docks. And we'll be focusing a little bit on the Blitz later this week. The bombers would kill 300 Londoners that day and wound 1,300 others, and the Thames itself would burn with oil and the destruction of shipping and other manufacturing and industrial infrastructure along the docks. The next attack comes on the 15th of September, but because of the attack the week before, the RAF were one step ahead of the Luftwaffe, and they really had a kind of a dry run for dealing with the scale of the attack. So the RAF assembled 23 squadrons of fighters to protect London, and the squadrons have plenty of warning and are able to gain altitude, most crucially, in time. So they're not there racing to get to height before the ME-109s turn up. The ME-109s have to go home as a result of fuel shortages, and this leaves the bombers absolute sitting ducks as they attack London again. Later that afternoon, a second wave of bombers comes over, and a similar process occurs. The ME-109s have to return back to northern France, and at the end of the day, 56 aircraft had been shot down, and there had been 29 fighters lost by the RAF, and 12 pilots killed. And the attacks that come after the 15th of September are never really on the same scale or have the same strength. On the 16th of September, Goering convinced himself that the attacks had been a devastating success and the RAF had been all but wiped out, losing, he believed they'd lost nearly 200 aircraft, which shows either poor intelligence or just a willful desire to select the worst intelligence going. Probably the latter is my guess. The Battle of Britain doesn't necessarily end in so much as it transitions into the Blitz. One campaign neatly becomes, or perhaps not so neatly, becomes another. But what does end in September 1940 are any realistic ambitions of an invasion. And Hitler postpones indefinitely Operation Sea Lion on the 2nd of October 1940. The members of the German High Command who'd had their misgivings about Operation Sea Lion also shared them about the likely results of heavy city bombing on British morale. It was generally thought amongst many of Hitler's generals that this would do very little, and it would do almost nothing to break Britain's war industries, as the Luftwaffe just don't have the capacity in terms of heavy bombers in order to achieve such a goal. Instead, it was thought that strangling Britain using U-boats in the Atlantic was a far more realistic prospect, and in that assumption, they're nearly right. Anyway, I hope you found this useful and enjoyable, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Do remember, if you can, to give us a good write-up on iTunes, and if you can check out our Patreon page, that would be grand as well. All the best. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.